All right. So the title, once again, is Asymptotic Freedom. Spectral Index. Upstream. And this is based on work which is partly done, partly in progress, with Cheryl Sorokin and Kumran. You saw Cheryl on Thursday last week, and if you like him, you'll see him today. Come on, it's here. Oh, here's Kirill. So, first part of this work has already appeared on HEPTH, and the corresponding HEPT number is 0505204. Yeah, that's right. And there is a second part, which hopefully will appear sometime soon in the future. Meanwhile, while I'm talking, you can enjoy reading the handout which I prepared for you. It's somewhere there in the middle table, and if you're lucky, the ring will bring us more in the color. Okay, so first I'll start with introduction, and by the way, those who need this information, please copy it now, because it will be gone in the second round once I come to this side of the blackboard. So since this is one of the first talks on topological strings, I should really introduce what the topological strings are, describe some of the basic properties that will be useful to us. I'm sure that it will appear in many more talks, so I think it will be helpful to give a very brief introduction into the subject. So for us and for many other talks, the main interest will be in studying topological strings on a Calabi-Yau threefold, which I'll denote X. And then, just as in usual string theory, topological string theory deals with maps from Riemann surfaces of genus G, sigma G, into Calabi-Yau space X. This is the map, which has to obey certain conditions, such as to be holomorphic, etc. And then, outcome of this machinery is an object, Z topological, which is partition function of the topological string theory, and as usual, it's written as exponential of sum over g lambda to the 2g minus 2fg, which is organized according to the genus expansion. So, can you see this part of the blackboard? Sorry if I'm writing too close to the edge. So it's organized according to the genus expansion, and various terms here correspond to which genus of the Riemann surface we are looking at. And this object, as well as such a problem, can be interesting for several reasons. So topological means that it's much simpler than the physical string theory. So in fact, in some sense, infinitely simpler is like an integrable version of a physical string theory. But the reason it's interesting is, first of all, that it actually computes certain properties of the physical string theory, namely various dynamical quantities which are protected by supersymmetry. So I should say that topological string computes effective action of type 2 string physical string this time on LIBLX. So if you want to study compactification and know some and ask certain questions about effective four-dimensional physics, we can resort to topological string, use the fact that we, in many cases, we can actually compute this partition function and determine some quantities exactly. This includes a very large class of effective field theories, four-dimensional field theories, including Seibert-Witten type theories, etc. So it's pretty powerful. And secondly, another reason to be interested in this partition function is that it computes interesting topological, I'll put topological in quotes, invariants of the Calabi-Yau space X. Okay? And I want to make this a little bit more precise now. Roughly speaking, the invariants that topological string computes are here. These are kind of coefficients of the genus expansion of the partition function, again labeled by genus. But depending on the context, and I'll make this very specific in a second, these invariants aren't really topological invariants. They depend on some extra structure that we put on a Calabi-Yau. And there are two natural structures on a Calabi-Yau, namely the Keller structure and the complex structure. And correspondingly, there are two types of topological strings. There is A model and B model, which ask questions related to these two types of structures. Okay. So in the A model, this coefficient Fg, which I wrote over there, is actually, well, it certainly depends on the Calabi-Yau that we choose, but it also depends on this additional structure, namely the Keller structure of Calabi-Yau. So T here represent Keller moduli. And it has the following form. It's obtained as a sum over classes in H2 of the Calabi-Yau of invariants labeled by genus and the class times T to the beta. Okay? And these invariants here are genus G Gromov-Eaton invariants. Okay? So this free energy or partition function, generating function of Gromov-Eaton invariants, the A model, I believe will appear tomorrow in Ulbricht's talk. And as I say, probably in many, many further talks during the workshop. So in the B model, similarly we define Fgs, but now they depend on the choice of Calabi-Yau and complex structure moduli. This theory in some sense is simpler because if here you have to count stable maps from Riemann surface into Calabi-Yau, then compute the degree of that moduli space, which is quite a horrendously complicated problem in general. Here often you get some answers which can be simply expressed in terms of Hoare structure periods of the Calabi-Yau, and I'll give you an answer for the first term here, which corresponds to genus zero. It's really simple, and as I say, it can be nicely expressed in terms of periods, namely choosing a basis of symplectic basis of A cycles and B cycles in the Calabi-Yau, which I'll call AI and BJ. We can integrate the holomorphic three-form, unique covariantly constant non-trivial three-form on a Calabi-Yau over such cycles and get the corresponding quantities which will denote xi and fi. These are common names for these guys. Now, interesting thing is that these are not completely unrelated, and these objects here, fj, can be expressed as derivatives locally of a function, since holomorphic function f naught over xj's, okay. So this function is precisely the genus zero piece of the B model partition function, which can be, again, very easily expressed by integrating, roughly speaking, B periods with respect to variables defined by A periods. So you can continue this. Story gets a little bit more complicated, but conceptually is somewhat similar. F1, which is the genus 1 piece, is in some sense a holomorphic version of the ray singular torsion. And you can continue further on to define high genus terms in this expansion for the B model. And again, they'll depend on complex structure of the Calabi-Yau. And there is actually a very nice recursion relation with which allows you with some additional input to reconstruct all genus terms here recursively from starting from the first one and then successively increasing the genus. And this procedure is called holomorphic anomaly. I mean, it's encoded in the holomorphic anomaly equation, which was understood in a very nice paper by Bruschatsky, Sikwati, Aguri, and Waffa, which is often referred as BCOV. Okay, so this is roughly what A model and B model compute for us. And as I say, crucial point is that one depends on Keller structure, the other depends on complex structure. And under mirror symmetry, the two are exchanged, which means that with some identification of complex and Keller moduli, we can write Z topological for the A model of a Calabi-Yau X and moduli T is the same, is equal to topological partition function of a B model on a different Calabi-Yau X tilde with some moduli Z. So there is a map between T and Z, which makes this inequality. And if you understand what the map is, then it takes a minute by computing this side to extract interesting information about Gromov-Witten invariance on the other side. And this is precisely the celebrated use of mirror symmetry conjecture to compute Gromov-Witten invariance. Now let's spend another minute on it. The number of Keller structure parameters here is given by H11. This is precisely the number of harmonic two forms on a Calabi-Yau that many of you have already seen last week, appearing a few times. So this is the number of T's here. Similarly, number of complex structure deformations of the mirror Calabi-Yau is captured by H21. So I'll make it a bit more explicit to emphasize which Calabi-Yau it depends on. So the mirror symmetry wouldn't make sense unless these two numbers are equal. And this is the simplest version of mirror symmetry conjecture, which says that given a Calabi-Yau with a Hodge diamond, which looks as usual like 1, H11, H11, H21, H12, 11. Okay. This indicate non-trivial entries of the watch diamond for a Calabi-Yau. So the simplest version of the mirror symmetry conjecture, which is topological mirror symmetry, says that for every such Calabi-Yau, there is another one which has H21 and H1 exchanged, H11 exchanged, meaning that watch diamond is inverted with respect to this diagonal. And this version of the mirror symmetry conjecture, which is called enumerative mirror symmetry, says that not only topology of these two varieties are related, but also some interesting, some non-trivial functions, which either are generating functions of Gromov-Witten invariants or some invariants of the Hodge structure, are related as well. Okay. So now let's go a bit further. Any questions about this part? Now, interesting thing is that, which is still not fully understood, is that all these functions, although I'm reading them down pretty explicitly and convincingly, so it seems like they may exist and make sense. In fact, they are not really functions, this topological string partition function. Namely, the next crucial point is that topological string partition function, which I denote Z-top, is actually a wave function. This was realized first, again, in this paper by BCOV, and further clarified by Witten in early 90s. Sorry? Yeah, first of all, that's right. So, first of all, it's a section of a certain length bundle, but I don't even want to think, I mean, even that doesn't quite capture the essential nature of this function. Actually, I should probably it might be a good time to do it anyway. Let me notice the following. Let's focus for a second on the B model. In the A model, conclusion should be similar if mirror symmetry is to hold. But in the B model, it's a little bit nicer because, remember, we defined the periods, A periods, to be integrals over the holomorphic 3 form over basis of A cycles. And the number of such guys, namely the index I here, runs from 0 to H21. So there are H21 plus 1 of them in total. Okay, so this defines projective coordinates on the moduli space of Calabi-Yau. I'll save some space here to draw a picture, cartoon of the moduli space of Calabi-Yau. So this will be some complex. So it looks like we have one extra variable here, which certainly makes sense because overall rescaling of the holomorphic three form by any non-zero complex number doesn't change actually the position in the moduli space. So it looks like we have this projective degree of freedom. However, this extra scale factor has a very nice physical meaning. And to explain that, let's notice the following fact. It is very clear from the definition I gave for F0 and even for F1, but it's true in general that the function FG of this more complex projective complex structure moduli XI is a homogeneous function of degree 2 minus 2G. Okay. More precisely, mathematically speaking, it's actually a section of a line bundle whose trunk class is 2 minus 2g, or I could write it section of line bundle L to the tensor power 2 minus 2g, where L itself is a line bundle over the complex structure moduli space where the holomorphic 3 form takes values in. Anyway, if you're not comfortable with language of line bundles, just think of the fact that it's homogeneous of degree 2 minus 2g. And notice that fg appeared in that expansion with a factor 2g minus 2, okay? Which means that overall rescaling of this projective coordinates x really plays the same role as the coupling constant, string coupling constant in that expansion. Therefore, what people often do is we take this total h21 plus 1 projective coordinates on the complex structure moduli space and increase it to and actually try to make sense of all of these variables. And obviously we think of first guys as actual moduli of the Calabi-Yau, which encode geometry of the Calabi-Yau, and this plus 1 as a coupling constant. So often, this particular period will be called X naught, and it's proportional to 1 over G string, 1 over lambda in my notation. Okay. Now, coming back to the point I had, not only, so this is the first point, and I kind of clarify that FG is naturally a section of a certain line bundle, but it doesn't capture the whole nightmare I'm about to come into. If that was the only mess, then all FGs and topological string partition function would be a nice holomorphic function or a section. Doesn't really matter. Thing is, it's not actually holomorphic, and this is precisely what holomorphic anomaly equation captures, as the name suggests, and this is related to the following fact. This function actually depends on the choice of point around which we are expanding this topological string partition function. So it captures dependence on the moduli, but it does it in a way which depends very crucially on a point where we have started in holomorphic as well as anti-holomorphic manner. So at first this may seem surprising and bizarre, and this is precisely this captured, as I say, by holomorphic anomaly equations, but there is actually a very simple and deep interpretation to it, which says that this extra dependence on the choice of omega naught is essentially the choice of polarization when we try to quantize the topological string. Namely, the tangent space to the moduli space, this little patch which I've drawn here, is a copy of H3 of XR. Okay? And this is where this guy takes value in. So in quantum version of a topological string, we are supposed to quantize the space which comes with a natural symplectic structure. And in order to do this, we have to choose which half of the variables here we call coordinates, canonical coordinates, and which ones we call momenta. So this is the usual split or choice we have to make once we are given a phase space with a symplectic structure. And this is precisely what's called choice of polarization. And point of this rather complicated looking holomorphic anomaly equation is that choice of polarization is precisely this choice dependence on the background in this language. So the upshot of it is that as we quantize H3 of XR with this symplectic structure, which does depend on the choice of polarization, we get actually a wave function, which I'll call C top for topological, which is nothing but a topological string partition function. Okay, I'll write it on that board. It's quite important for us.
Sure. Does this mean anyone? This is in the context of a topological thing. Does this mean that usual statement, many of the statements we use about background independence are overly naive? That somehow background dependence has physical meaning in some sense?
Yeah. It does. For instance, one question which is often being asked here is, since I told you earlier that topological string computes string quantities and the effective action in the four-dimensional physics, what does background dependence mean in there? And it means precisely the same thing. In fact, you can probably understand it even better, although it hasn't been made precise, but it's clear what it should mean. Namely, when we compute effective action, we compute effective action in the vicinity of some particular background, right? So we expand around a given vacuum, and this is precisely what dependence captures. So,
but can you say how the partition function really changes if you change your polarization? It should somehow transform polarity, or
exactly? Yeah. So
right.
Right. Once you know what the phase space is in symplectic structure is, and here it's very simple, you can actually demand that, I mean, you can write down how it should transform. For instance, if I go all the way from polarization where I interchange the role of coordinates and momenta, the wave function should transform by a Fourier transform, right? This is one of the crucial properties. So you can demand that, but then you realize that this is precisely this holomorphic anomaly equation. So you can, right, so I don't think I can say better what I just said.
So the dependence is determined by...
Yeah, the dependence is precisely this BCOV holomorphic anomaly equation. I'm not going to write it down. I mean, I can, but it's not terribly illuminating, because once we write it down, the goal will be to package it and massage it a little bit to actually see that this covariant dependence that you're asking for is precisely this equation. So I think it's better to leave it in words like this. Yeah, there was only one interpretation, so I can't give a table comparing two things because I have only one object at hand. All I was saying is that, so previously we were writing Z top for topological, which depends on Calabi-Yau and moduli, right? Now, and depending on either we work with A, B model, we could choose A or B. But now what I'm trying to say is that at least in the B model, it's interpretation of this BCOV holomorphic anomaly equation is that it also depends on a choice of a background holomorphic three form, omega naught here. Okay? So this is all I wanted to say. And then I gave its interpretation following these people, that it actually encodes dependence on polarization in the quantization of H3, which is a natural phase space for the B model, because as I say, it is supposed to capture information about complex structure. I glossed over several points here, but there were kind of two steps here. One is that it has background dependence, and second point was interpretation of it, of this background dependence. Second step is certainly much more delicate and deep, and still is not fully understood. Yeah. So, no. Symplectic structure is polarization. What you call P, what you call Q, is coordinates and momenta.
Which P and Q are you talking about? What physical variable would you use?
The
x's
are P.
Yeah, so we had here, remember, these guys parametrized. So, remember, we had x i's and f i's, right? Which were relevant variables. For for the B model, in principle, classically, F is a function of X, right? But what happens in quantum theory, these two do not commute, and when you quantize theory, you have to choose which variables you call classical coordinates and which you call canonical momenta.
I think it would be perhaps helpful if you say the difference of the, what X and F correspond to in the 4D effective field theory and it would, that would be a physical interpretation of what's the distinction between X and F. That would make it clear that your simplistic, what the simplistic structure you're talking about has to do with 4D physics.
You mean in terms of charges?
Well, in terms of vector multiplets, what does X and F correspond to in the vector multiplet for any of the supersymmetric theory?
So yeah, it's, I mean, these two are, but I'm not really sure if it's going to be helpful. These two, in effective field theory, will be related by electromagnetic duality. This will be, just like, think of, okay, maybe this is actually helpful. Think of Cyber-Quitten, right? Then there is no universal or canonical description of the U-plane, of the Coulomb branch, because depending on where we sit in the Coulomb branch, the notion of a fundamental degree of freedom changes. The photon, which is a good fundamental degree of freedom for semi-classical region of large U, is not a good variable at all for small U, etc. So there is no invariant notion. I mean, A and A dual, what we usually call, are not really good variables, right? I mean, their meaning changes, and they undergo symplectic transformations as we go from one region to the other. This A and A dual are precisely these variables, X and F. So, and they also undergo this type of symplectic transformations as we go around the moduli space. And this is the kind of so it does have a physical meaning. And as Kumaran is pointing out, this is indeed a good analogy maybe to try to explain it in four dimensional physics. No, it's precise. Yeah.
The mini version of this holomorphic anomaly that Sergey is mentioning is the fact that if you write the prepotential for anything supersymmetric theory, just for the field theory, if you write it from electric to magnetic variables, it undergoes a Lagrange transform. That's the classical version of Fourier transform. And Fourier transform reflects the wave function nature of that. So if you include the gravity degrees of freedom into the game, that Lagrange transform gets promoted to the Fourier transform, which gets promoted to the statement that F0, the prepotential and its gravitational corrections, assemble themselves to a wave function. And which basis you use to write it, transform just like the Fourier transform does from X2 to D4. That's the holomorphic anomaly.
Right, so just like there is no invariant way to write prepotential, I mean, it's not a simple function, right? It has non-trivial duality transformations. This is precisely what happens to the z-top. So it's, therefore, you could formulate this property of descending from some symplectic structure in the beginning of the problem. That's one way to do it. Second would be to think of it as really background dependence, or more mathematically, think of it as dependence on choice of polarizations. And statement is that all, I mean, we're talking about the same property here, which actually could be used to our advantage, since we know, I mean, if it transforms non-trivially, this is what it tells us, we could try to use it to extract some information about it, just like knowing that prepotential in Cyber-Quitten has to transform, we can actually solve the theory. The last one I'll try to clarify by the end of the talk. I hope you'll see it more explicitly. The other two I just want you to accept for now as facts because I can't go into further details. I mean, I can, but I don't have time.
Polarization, you mean that usual sense of helicity kind of thing?
No, polarization, I mean splitting phase space in coordinates and momenta.
Okay.
So what I was trying to say very, very briefly here is that what happens is that real part of X, real part of F, imaginary part of X, imaginary part of F, P pairwise get conjugate with each other, okay? So I have to choose which of the variables I'm talking about, either this set or this set, where I choose all of them real, that would be called real polarization, and that's more natural for black hole physics. It appears in Hitchens type story. This one where I have only x, but both real and imaginary part, is more like holomorphic polarization, and this is what actually topological string prefers in its perturbative definition. And so on. So by polarization, I really mean splitting and what I call coordinates and momenta.
How does that relate to the first background?
Yeah, I mean, if I understand correctly, choosing omega 0 means choosing a point in moduli space, a complex structure moduli space.
Right.
So it is a little bit unclear how choosing a point in moduli space is related to interchanging A cycles and B cycles. Because that's right, the duality
right. In full generality, if one could show this, this would be fantastic. In some examples, actually, you can see, for instance, in the case where you can compute this function in 12 genera, and you have to do it because, as I say here in this picture, string coupling gets unified with the rest of the variables. You can actually see that by going from one limit, one cusp region in the moduli space to the other cusp.
No, the question was much more elementary. How does choosing omega 0 give you a split into x's and p's? That's what he's asking.
How does it determine what's an A cycle and what's a B cycle? How can you, by changing omega 0, how can you change what's an A cycle and what's a B cycle?
So given omega 0 determines the splitting of homology to H3 0, H2 1, H1 2, well, using that you can call H3 0 plus H2 1 as your X's and the other ones as your P's. So choice of an omega 0 gives you a natural splitting of the first, the lower half and the upper half. That's, and they are paired symplectically. So each omega 0 can be used to give you canonical choice.
Yeah, this particular choice would be actually what I call holomorphic polarization, because you would be using a Hodge structure induced by omega to take half of the middle dimensional cohomology and call them momenta, for instance. But what I was saying is that you can actually see in some examples very concretely when you can compute this partition function that it does transform, does undergo a Fourier transform as you travel from one region in the moduli space to the other one. So, I mean, It's a non-trivial property which could be used as either outcome, a consistency check if you can compute it independently, or as a tool in many cases to actually extract what the entire partition function should be. And Albrecht has a dream to solve a quintic just using this kind of techniques. So, yeah.
Is this the same thing that's the sufficient condition for the embedding theorem?
Which is what?
Is that what you mean by polarization? Is it the same as the polarization class?
Yes.
Vision for the
yes.
Can you repeat the question?
I believe so. Can you actually make it more precise and then we'll comment on it?
So it's the embedding theorem, which says from the people on the left, and there's a sufficient condition, which is the existence of a polarization class. I just wondering if that was the same thing.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not sure. Sorry, why do you ask about algebraic?
That's the only thing I have for polarizations.
No, I believe the two notions are not unrelated, but I'm not using it. I don't know what would be the meaning of embedding theorem if that's literally what you want to use here. I think the two notions of polarization we are using are indeed exactly the same, but their application is different. So, okay. Right. So, we got to this statement which, if any of the comments above were helpful, that's great. If not, I ask you to accept as a fact that topological string partition function, this object we define, is actually a wave function. So this is the key and the first mysterious statement in this nice and beautiful story, which, as I say, we really want to understand much better So there are many questions here, and one particular way to understand it would be to realize this as a state on topological M-theory, some theory which has one extra dimension, and then canonical quantization of seven-dimensional theory on Calabi-Yau cross an R or cross an interval should produce some state, and it would be very natural to interpret this state precisely as a topological string wave function. Okay, so I won't spend more time on this, but the next interesting fact I want to tell you is that this object is further equal to Hartley-Hawking wave function. And I should tell you what that is. So it's a Hartley-Hawking wave function of a certain string background closely related to type 2 on a Calabi-Yau that I mentioned in the very beginning. So Hartley and Hawking proposed the following interesting scenario. So the scenario has to do with cosmology and the choice of initial conditions. So in string theory, we're very good by now at understanding lots of properties of static space-times and extracting a lot of subtle information about effective field theory to any order in coupling constant way beyond that we need in current experiments. However, we are very bad at explaining the origin of the universe and the choice, I mean, the initial conditions that set us up, okay? So Hartley and Hawking made the following proposal, which are supposed to explain evolution of the universe at the current stage. So I could draw the current universe roughly like this. So let me choose a spatial slice, which is indicated in red on the handout. So this will be our space-time manifold. We'll call it M9, thinking that we're in string theory, so there are 9 spatial dimensions. In original Hartley-Hawking proposal, it would be a three-dimensional slice, spatial slice of the universe, which then evolves according to equations of motion and describes the present cosmological stage. So in this evolution, T, the time, is usual Lorentzian time. So question is to explain the initial conditions in this evolution, and Hartley and Hawking made the following proposal. They said there is no kind of unique or preferred set of original initial conditions, except that somehow take and average over all of them, and here we're going to make it more precise. So they suggested that we should start with nothing in the very beginning and then have an instanton, which is Euclidean solution here, parameterized by Euclidean time tau, which describes how the universe is created from really nothing. So that's a gravitational instanton which goes from nothing to this non-trivial spatial manifold. So this is Euclidean space-time, and therefore it's convenient to write the wave function which describes the probability to find a very specific metric on the spatial slice to be the exponential of minus the action of the Euclidean instanton on this manifold, Euclidean manifold, which I call W. Okay. So this is the usual gravity action or supergravity, depending on the context. And then, of course, we would have to sum over all such manifolds which have the boundary that we fixed and integrate over all of the metrics on such manifolds with the fixed boundary conditions. So basically, the idea is that the spatial metrics here should be weighted with the weight of Euclidean instanton, which goes from nothing to a given spatial metric. So this is a very nice proposal. It's, as you can see, it's pretty canonical, I mean, as canonical as you could hope. It doesn't, I mean, it's very natural. We start from nothing, then we create our universe, then we can evolve it, and in the end we get a very general wave function on whole infinite dimensional space of all metrics on a given manifold. In fact, we could even ask how different topologies are related by this context, etc. So it's very general and very nice, but this is precisely the flaw or drawback of this proposal, because it's so general, it's very hard to realize in any concrete setting, and of course we can't in practice do any of these integrals or sums. Okay? Yes? Oh, W is a... So, in this case, it's a 10-manifold Euclidean 10-dimensional manifold. Yeah, with Euclidean... Right, so... They proposed to glue two solutions to Einstein equations along the boundary M, one of which is... of signature 1 comma n, and the other is of signature n plus 1. Of course, there should be also some suitable choice of boundary conditions on the metric and its derivative, which says that this boundary is totally geodesic, in order for us to glue the two solutions in a nice, reasonable way. But as I say, basic idea is that we take 10-dimensional manifolds in this context, or would be 4-dimensional manifolds if we do just 4-dimensional physics, and require that they have a given boundary, and then just compute basically the Einstein-Hilbert action or a string effective action for this gravitational instanton, and make this the weight and the in the wave function. Yes.
What is the argument of the function,
GM? GM is the metric on this spatial slice. And here we integrating and summing over geometries, put differently, over the metrics on this cobordism from empty space to M, such which have fixed boundary conditions at the boundary. Make sense? Okay, so as I say, it's very general, it's beautiful, but it's hard to do anything with this. Except if you take this very general proposal and truncate it to some limited set of modes, some very specific deformations of the metric. Some if you instead of viewing this wave function to be wave function in space of all metrics on a given spatial manifold or all manifolds, just consider variation of say one or two parameters, and this is this makes the problem practical. So in its very usual situation that we use in physics very often, we assume that problem has certain symmetry and then try to look at solutions which respect this particular symmetry. So what Hartley and Hawking originally did, they considered a three-manifold, three-dimensional spatial slice, which was just a three-sphere, and considered variation, or this wave function, how it depends on the radius of this of the spatial three-sphere, which gets interpreted as cosmological constant in... In the gravity theory. Okay, so this kind of limited, truncated version of the wave function, which is often called mini superspace, is going to appear for us as well. So I'll come back to it in a second, but now let me make this statement more concrete. the proposal, which is due to Aguri, Waffa, and Verlinde, is that the wave function that we had such a difficult time understanding, this topological string partition function, is precisely the Hartree-Hawking wave function in a certain physical context. So let me first write it down and then comment on it. So statement is that, again, C topological, which is just equivalent to Z topological, we're just thinking of it in a slightly different way here. It's also equal to Hartree-Hawking wave function for flux complexifications of type 2, type 2a, or in their context, type 2b, string theory, on a very specific nine-dimensional manifold, M9, which is of the form S1 cross S2 cross Calabi-Yau, which again, I'll continue calling X. So this is one, this is a circle, this is a two-sphere, and that's a Calabi-Yau. Calabi-Yau has...
A or B?
Right. So A or B correlates with either we use type 2A or type 2B here. So I was just about to say that, as we saw before, Calabi-Yau has, in principle, two types of moduli. It has either Keller moduli or complex structure, which come in quantities H11 and H21, right? So topological string partition function A or B is related to A or B string compactification, and depends on either complex structure moduli or Keller structure moduli, respectively, depending on the setup. So I won't be very specific until I go through some examples, which ones I'm using, because the two are related by mirror symmetry and t-duality in the physical setup. Okay, so the picture is the following, that we start with type 2 string theory, which lives in 10 dimensions, right? Then we compactify it down to 4 dimensions, where we find some four-dimensional effective physics, effective theory, and the usual counting that 4 plus 6 is equal to 10 tells us that this is the way it goes, that starting with 10 dimensions, we end up in a four-dimensional theory, and moreover, we are looking at overall nine-dimensional spatial universe, which has form S1, S2, and Calabi-Yau. It also has some fluxes along S2 and 3 cycles in a Calabi-Yau if you're working in type 2B setup, but at the moment I'm going to gloss over this issue. I'll probably make it a little bit more concrete in a short while, but that's all I had to say at the moment. So let me just make now a few comments about this. So this is really cute, because until now we didn't have any, first of all, we didn't have much input into cosmology with string theory. And this is, I would say, one of the first points where questions about these initial conditions can be made realized. Secondly, so it's a very specific realization of the Hartree-Hawking wave function. Secondly, unlike pure gravity, here we have the full string theory. So in fact, what we have is improvement of the Hartree-Hawking wave function to all orders in interaction in the gravity strength, which now makes sense because we're doing string theory. And the last point, general remark I'm going to make is that just like here, it was easier to deal with some mini superspace, namely consider the specific fluctuations of the metric, view this wave function as a function of on the subset of this huge infinite dimensional space of metrics. Here, we also have a very simple form of the Hartley-Hawking wave function, which depends only on the zero mode, so to say, of this compactification, namely either on Keller structure moduli or on complex structure moduli, which is precisely the set that is easier to handle and deal with in practice.
Wave functions should also satisfy some wave equation, like in this case, I guess it is really the Witt kind of equation. So this, I guess, if you work out, this comes out. Does it work now with this identification of sine equals z?
Yeah, so in this case, Wheeler-DeWitt equation is satisfied, as was checked in the paper, and in fact is satisfied for a rather simple reason, because I think conceptually, just because the theory is topological, or because we start with a theory which isn't variant under local gauge transformations, diffeomorphisms. So I think that's.
But there's no corrections to Wheeler-DeWitt equation because people have been unhappy about Wheeler-DeWitt equation itself because, well, for various reasons. Or you get spot on Wheeler-DeWitt, or you get Wheeler-DeWitt plus string corrections.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that the higher correction of topological space?
Yeah, but yeah, I can't actually comment much on higher order corrections. But as far as classical limits go, the classical limit goes, it is satisfied for quite a simple reason.
Sergey, yes. It seems like we have a little more to go. Shall we take a break? You think? How much more?
I would be definitely done within half an hour for sure, but it may be actually a good point to take a break if people feel like that, because this was a story, and in the second part, which is about to start, or will start in 5 minutes, I'll tell you two applications of this wave function, so it is a natural point to break.
An announcement for those of you who weren't here in the beginning. There's a sign-up sheet for Wednesday being passed around. Please make sure
this doesn't stop.
The Cumrun's talk will be on the beach.